Accession number 10936, Reel 2.
Mr. Downing, Reel 2.
There was no way that the Russians could find out or get a list of naval personnel who'd served on the convoys. But with the start of the North Russia Club, they were able, for the first time, to identify people who'd been on the North Russian runs. And they decided that even though it was 40 years on, they would issue a medal to the British sailors who'd served on Russian convoys. And so we found ourselves 40 years after the end of the war, going to the, about 200 of us, went to the Russian embassy, and the Russian ambassador thanked us and gave us a commemorative medal.
When would the North Russia Club have been formed then?
It would be, what, we're now 1989, we've got to be going back to 1985. 1985, I think. Yeah. I had a further surprise later on when, because of the medal, the Russian newspaper Pravda phoned me and asked if they could interview me. And they sent a reporter down, and they wanted to know what it was like in Russia, what the Russian convoys were like, and how we liked the Russian people. And I gave an interview to a reporter from Pravda. And in due course, he sent me a copy of Pravda with the article in it, which of course was something I couldn't read, not having enough knowledge of the language to do so. And I thought I would ask the Ministry of Defence if they would, which was probably a bit over the top, but I asked the Ministry of Defence if they would decode it for me, and I had a rather I don't know if he was annoyed, but he sounded slightly annoyed. Man from the Ministry of Defence phoned me up to say that they were not running a translation bureau, but in fact he would cooperate if I was prepared to wait. And of course, in due course, I did wait. And eventually they sent me a very, very good translation of the interview I gave to the Russian, which I treasure greatly.
Was it accurate?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed, it was. Yeah.
Some other people who've been on the convoys to Russia have told me that Murmansk was a depressing and backward sort of place. Is that true?
I didn't see a lot of Murmansk because I was at Polyano, which is down the inlet from Murmansk, and my trips into Murmansk were extremely few, and I wouldn't really... I mean, you're in a land of snow and ice and a few buildings. I mean, the whole thing wasn't really a place that would fill you with joy. But my own experience is at Polyano. Now, Polyano is a strange place. It's really a naval base, and still is, I believe. I think it's probably more important now than it was then, a Russian naval submarine base. And it was really, there was one enormous brick building there, which covered almost everything that was happening in Polyano, and our wireless station and our quarters were all in this brick building. That was quite a good building. In fact, it was a very good building. There was nothing wrong with that at all. It withstood the extremely low temperatures very well. We were warm in there. We had no problem with that. Outside of this big building, there was very little at all. A short distance away up on a hill, there was the Krasny Flot Club, the Red Fleet Club, which I mentioned that we went to see our films and we gave concerts there. That, again, was a good building. Apart from that, my memory tells me it was only wooden buildings around there. I don't remember much at all. There wasn't a lot at Polyano at all, apart from the naval base, the naval club, and a few buildings. It was easy to get on your skis and get up on the hills around there. And one of the few joys of the place was that they played Tchaikovsky, mainly, of course, on loudspeakers on poles around Poliana. And if you skied up on top of the hills and looked down at the naval base, you had this most extraordinary concert bowl effect of the music coming up at you from out of the snow. It was really something quite magnificent up there.
Now, coming back to an earlier period of the war, you were, I think, in 1940 on the notorious East Coast convoys.
That's right.
Can you tell me which ships you were on? And
yes, surely. I was on the Curacao there. It's a 4,000-ton cruiser. And we were based on Scapa Flow. And they were very, very noisy, those East Coast convoys at that time, because there were constant air attacks every time a convoy came down the East Coast. And we were one of the main anti-aircraft ships. I think we could empty our magazines if we fired continuously for half an hour. That was the sort of gunnery we had on it. We were bristling with guns, 4.7s, Oerlikons, and much smaller guns. We really were a noisy, noisy ship. We were getting attacked by aircraft which we understood came from Stavanger in Norway. And as I say, the 4.7s, the pom-poms, 0.5 machine guns, Maxims, made us a very noisy companion. In the 9 months that I remember the activity going on there before I left her, we steamed up and down the East Coast. 30,000 miles was what I was told, anyway, by the navigating officer. I left there because we were one wireless operator too many. We were a happy crew there. And I was very fed up about leaving, but I lost the toss, and I was drafted away. Not long afterwards, off the coast of Ireland, the Curacao was escorting the Queen Mary, and there was a mix-up in the navigation, and the Queen Mary cut the Curacao in half, and about 400 of the crew, who had all been friends of mine, were lost on that tragic, in broad daylight in the afternoon, too. A very sad business.
On the East Coast convoy attacks, how much success did the German aircraft have?
They had quite a lot of success. There were lots of hits. And of course, conversely, there were lots of aircraft shot down. Yeah. We did pretty well at shooting down aircraft. I think, in all honesty, with all the complicated gear we had on our anti-aircraft cruiser, our success rate wasn't much better than the chaps on trawlers and small ships who were just pointing their guns upwards and firing, because they had great successes too. Yeah.
What kind of planes did the Germans use for the attacks? Do you remember?
I think they were Focke-Wulfs. They were Focke-Wulfs, but I don't know the number. I don't know the numbers. No. I'm pretty certain they were Focke-Wulfs.
Did the German pilots press home their attacks with courage?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. They, you know, they were flying very, very low, coming over very low, and really getting down to it. Yeah. Oh yes, it was quite. There's no doubt about the courage of the German pilots on this at all. Except on one, I saw two German pilots very afraid once. That was when the plane had been shot down, and they were in the water in some sort of Carly float or something or other. They were in a small float, two of them. And we were standing off them. And the gunnery ratings, to get a better view of them with their telescopic sights, trained all their guns on them. And I think these poor souls really thought they were going to be blown out of the water, because they were terribly excited and obviously quite scared, but this cruiser with all its guns pointing at them. But it was, the guns were being pointed at them merely because the telescopic sights were being pointed at them. But they were, yes, we had no doubt at all that we were dealing with some very brave people there.
Did the German aircraft press home their attacks in ones?
No, in waves. in waves. They came one after another. I was sometimes on the bridge with the captain during the attacks. The wireless operators sometimes had to go on the bridge because there was radio telephone as well from the bridge. And I had some very good views of these attacks up there. But I think the abiding memory I have is of the coolness of the captain, Hughes Hallett, well-known name in the Navy. CC, I think, was his initials, but there are two Hughes Hallets, but this was CC. I'm pretty certain it was CC Hughes Hallett. But I have some very, very good memories of him on the bridge watching the bombs falling out of planes and giving signals like starboard 20 to avoid them, or port 15 to avoid these. Absolutely calm, ice calm, just watching the fall of the bombs and steering the ship away from them. Absolutely fantastic man. I think he became an admiral. There was an Admiral Hughes Hallett, but there are a family, really, the Hughes Halletts.
Was there any particular point on the East Coast which was particularly dangerous, or was it all equally dangerous?
Oh, it was, really. The whole of the East Coast was a sort of bomb alley. Yes. Yes, it was pretty rough all down the East Coast.
Did you have any problems with mines there?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah. Yes, because no one quite knew where they'd been laid and when they'd been laid. Oh, yes, there were plenty of ships lost with this. Yes, it was a very dangerous run down there. Later on, in the war, I was on the East Coast on MTBs. And there weren't anywhere near the air raids at that time. The air attacks were very, very few at that time. This is at the back end of the war. I did the last year of the war on MTBs. And that was a different sort of East Coast then. The E-boats were the menace then. And on calm nights, they would come right over to our side. And, of course, we were doing the same thing there. On rough nights, the MTBs would go out about 3 miles. And in pairs, they would, every few miles apart down the East Coast, we would wait to see if the E-boats came over. And if they did, of course, we were there. But on flat calm nights, some would be left behind and some would be doing offensive sweeps down the Dutch coast. We used to do a sweep down the Dutch coast off Terschelling, and we used to say we were going to shoot up windmills.
Were the British MTBs a match for the E-boats?
Yes, they were. Once we were going at speed, they were diesel. And they had an extra 5 knots on us. We could do 45 knots. We were petrol driven. The boats that I spent most of my time on, or the boat I spent most of my time on, was a Vosper 72 footer, which carried 4 torpedo tubes. It was only a short boat, but 4 torpedo tubes. And our speed at top whack was 45. The E-boats could do 50. But they had the disadvantage of being diesel. They couldn't do a crash start as we could. We could get up to our 45 in no time at all, whereas the E-boats took quite a while to get up to their 50 knots. But apart from that, boat to boat, it was an even match. Yeah. I liked that period of my war better than all the rest, I think. There was something absolutely exhilarating in doing 40-odd knots across the sea, with your stern down and the bow out of the water and ploughing along and the pennants flying and half a dozen of you in either line ahead or formation going across to do a sweep down the Dutch coast. A really exciting thing on the little boats. And, of course, nearly all the officers were RMVR. It was almost a completely different navy from the RN. Almost all the officers were RMVR.
Were you RN or RMVR?
Well, neither, really. I suppose I was RN, but the hostilities only I was called. When I was called up, and I got my papers soon after the war broke out in 39. I mean, I was in the Navy by January. It was for... In fact, I think I knew I was going. That's right, I was told I was going before war actually broke out, because I was going to do 6 months military training as a militiaman and then come out with a sports jacket and flannels. I remember I had this notion. And then, of course, war broke out, and I was in the Navy proper, and the six months went on a bit.
On these sweeps on the Dutch coast, what was the object of them?
Oh, we were looking for merchant ship and German convoys. Looking for merchant ships and German convoys, yes. And then the normal drill would be to send... to create a diversion round one side of the convoy. That is to say that you'd send three boats would go round one side of the convoy, make a lot of noise, fire a few star shells and attract the gunfire. And on the other side, of course, another three boats would go in and send the tinfish in. That was the ploy, and it was a fairly well-known ploy, really. I mean, but that was the system at work. But I found this a tremendously exciting period here. I was on a flotilla leader. I was the wireless operator on a flotilla leader. And I liked this. I really enjoyed that aspect of it. These were exciting boats. You really felt that you were really in it and doing something.
Did you have much success against these convoys?
Much. Much is difficult. Some. We had some, yeah. A lot of it was... waving the flag, I thought. We were showing them that we could do it, that we were up there and about, and that there were enemy attacks on their convoys. We damaged a lot of ships, sunk some, yes.
Did you have radar?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we had radar. I think it started to be called radar. Yes, it was called radar then. They'd gone from RDF then, hadn't they? Yes, by this end of the war, they'd gone, and it was called radar. And... in fact, on my little MTB, the radio cabin, for want of a better word, was oh, it if you sat down, you couldn't move very much, and you had the set in front of you, the radio set in front of you. And next door was another little cabin with the radar set in it, and you were side by side. The radar operator and the sparker were side by side, each in their own little cabins. But they really were tiny little cabins. The real, if you had time to worry about it, the real worrying thing was, of course, they're only made of five ply plywood. Those MTBs were made of, and they carried I don't know how many thousand gallons of high octane petrol, so that there was very little armament for the sparker sitting down. In fact, the sparker, as usual, in most of these things, knew very little about what was going on. The spar... if an MTB goes into attack, the boat itself is part of the projection of the torpedo, and so the skipper on the bridge goes at full pelt and points the boat at the target. That's the way you sight it. You point your boat at the target. And then you fire the fish. And from doing 45 knots, the boat stops from the recoil. Now, sitting down below with his earphones on, the sparker is not ready for this. So, the sparker's idea of the action is that he's suddenly hurled across his little cabin, finishes up banging against the bulkhead. And this happens all the time to sparkers, I'm afraid. They have very little idea of what the action is. You hear the noise, you smell the cordite in the air coming through the vents, and all the noise going on, and you really are not mixed up in what is going on, that you can't see a lot of it. That's why on the Curacao it was nice to be on the bridge and see what was going on, but on these other ships, of course, the sparker is way out of sight of the action.
Were these German convoys escorted by e-boats, or what, bigger ships?
I don't ever remember e-boats. I expect some of them were, but I remember armed trawlers mainly, armed trawlers escorting them, and quite small armed ships escorting them. One of the hazards, of course, was not knowing what sort of ships they were, and if they were flat-bottom boats, of course, you had to set a zero setting on the torpedoes to get anywhere with them at all. I think this was one of the problems of torpedo fighting, but a very exhilarating business, that. The MTB Association is quite strong now in peace. I still belong to the Coastal Forces Association, and we still meet. A very, very strong association there, like the North Russia Club.
Can we pick up another aspect of your work in the war when you were serving with the Stella...
Carina? Stella Carina.
Carina.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
What was this ship?
She was a trawler, a Grimsby trawler.
Can you tell me about her?
Yes, I can. This is one of my favourite topics, the Stella. I told you that I was at... Did I tell you? I went to Gibraltar and I was at Rockwiler Station, Gibraltar, for a year.
You told me off the record,
yeah.
But if you would repeat this again.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I from the Curacao, when I was drafted off the Curacao, I went to Gibraltar Wireless Station, which was... The wireless station itself was in one of the deepest shelters in the rock. The rock was not, in my time, subject to any air raids, but if it had, we were safe. We had a beautiful little bungalow, the wireless staff at Rock WT. We kept chickens, we had eggs, the food was good, we swam in a warm sea, and I joined the symphony orchestra. And after I'd done this for about the best part of a year, my conscience got at me, and I thought, I'm not doing a lot to win the war here. And I volunteered to go to sea again. It's extraordinary, isn't it, when you look back on the silly things you do. I volunteered to go to sea again. And I was drafted to a trawler called the Stella Carina. Life on trawlers is very, very different from life in the Royal Navy as such. And I learned this as soon as I went down to the jetty at Gib to join the ship, because the sparker I was relieving was waiting on the jetty to go with his bag and his hammock. And he shook me by the hand and he said, "Right ho, enjoy yourself, Sparks," and he went off. I said, "Well, aren't you going to tell me something about where the confidential books are?" He said, "They're in the skipper's sock drawer." And I said, "Haven't you got a safe?" And he said, "Yes, the cook keeps the meat in it." And this was my introduction to trawler life. I was the only non-fisherman on board the Stella Carina. All the other chaps were from Grimsby, Hull, Fleetwood, with a fishing skipper. She was an anti-submarine trawler, ASIC trawler. And we went along on Malta convoys, but never got into any serious trouble because I don't think the target of a trawler attracted much attention, but we saw a lot of action going down there. I was actually there when the Ark Royal was sunk. Very close, when the Ark Royal was hit.
Can you describe that?
Well, it was just a tragic day, really, when this great ship suddenly, and not suddenly, slowly, settled down, toppled to one side, went down. I heard afterwards there were casualties. At the time, we thought there hadn't been any casualties because there was sufficient time to get everybody off. But this was the ship which Lord Haw-Haw had said he'd sunk over and over and over again, and there she was really going down. It was really, really was tragic. But it seemed to take forever to actually go down. She settled down very, very slowly, and I had thought at the time that everyone had got off. But I have read since that there were some casualties there, and I was very sad about it, because it may be that they were hurt in the explosion of the torpedo hitting. Or maybe they were killed by that.
Did the Stella Carina pick up any survivors?
Yes, we had some on board, and we took them back to Gib.
What condition were they in?
Oh, they were quite all right. I mean, they'd been on a big ship which had been hit in one place and was sinking, but they had suffered no hardship at all.
But they'd been in the water.
No, we took them off. As I remember it, we went alongside and took them off on ladders, on rope ladders. Yeah. We took them off on there, but there were plenty of ships around taking off survivors.
Were German attacks going on whilst the rescue operation was in progress?
Yes, yes, indeed, yes, yeah. But
I'm interested in these North Country fishermen.
Yes,
whom you served with. What were they like?
Oh, smashing chaps! They really, really were smashing. I was surprised to find that a lot of them had difficulty in writing letters home, and my position at first was a little bit strange, because I'd come from proper Navy, been on a cruiser and a proper shore station at Gibraltar, and I was more or less a pusser Navy man, and I came onto this trawler, and Of course, there was no sign of a uniform anywhere. The captain sometimes wore a cap, of course. There was no time. They rarely got out of their clothes while they were at sea, because this is where fishermen do live. I mean, they're on a small boat, and they didn't get out of their clothes very much. And the idea of shaving every day, which I did, struck them as being very, very strange. It took them quite a time to get used to me, as it took me some time to get used to them. But I found them salt-of-the-earth chaps. You could go anywhere with them. They were the finest sailors I'd ever seen. I mean, I remember on one very, very rough Atlantic trip, because apart from Malta convoys, what we were also doing was going straight out into the Atlantic, a couple of hundred miles, picking up a tanker which was coming in to the Med and escorting it, doing the anti-submarine escort right back into Gib. And, of course, 200 miles out in a 500-ton trawler, at times it was very, very rough. And I do remember an occasion when things got really, really, I thought, as a sort of wartime-only sailor from a fairly big ship, now on a small ship, I thought that we were going to sink. It looked as rough as that, because the depth charges had broken loose and were rolling round the deck. The small boat had been washed away. The spud locker had gone. There were great green waves towering above us and crashing down on the deck. And the coxswain was on the wheel. The little caboose in which the wireless operator works is immediately behind the wheelhouse, and you chat to the man on the wheel. And so I was getting very worried about all this, and I said to the coxswain, "Do you think we're going to get through this all right?" And he said to me, "I've fished in worse weather than this." And this was the attitude of these chaps. They're marvellous, marvellous sailors. I think that there were trawlers sunk, and some of the Gibraltar trawlers got sunk. But there was a certain feeling on a trawler that they wouldn't waste anything on you, I felt.
Did they give helm orders in the same way that the Royal Navy gave them?
Oh, yes. It was a little more... They used to take up by the stars sometimes. Most extraordinary, they would take the ship by the stars. It was nothing like the real Navy at all for me. It was quite strange about it. We also did a very strange job when we were escorting a cable ship. And since I later worked for Cable and Wireless, it was quite strange, really. It was the Mirror, the cable ship Mirror, and she was mending a cable which had broken off Cape St. Vincent. I think it was off Cape St. Vincent, a corner of Spain or Portugal. And this job took about 4 or 5 days in fairly calm sea, and we steamed a 1 mile circle around the cable ship for all that time while the cable was being mended. We were on tenterhooks the whole time because we were sitting targets there. The only benefit we got out of that was that on the cable ship they had a proper bakery, and we used to get bread off them every day, fresh bread, which was quite a treat for us. Because this is one of the snags about trawler life, is that 3 or 4 days out of your port and you're on biscuits and hardtack, really. And if it gets rough, of course, the cook can't cook on those galleys in a trawler. I came home on that trawler back to Milford Haven.
If I can ask you finally about a final period when you were on convoys to Normandy at the time of D-Day, could you tell me which ship you were on then? And
yes, I was
about
on
the duties you did.
Yes, we went. I was on a motor launch 202 there, and we went in at Arromanches ahead of Canadian troops. It was a Canadian beach that we went in at, and